In the spoken meditation, I named the tension between our UU first principle of the inherent worth and dignity of every person and the policy of many countries, including our own, of not keeping track of enemy and civilian casualties. And in this morning's sermon title, my intention is to name a similar tension between our UU fifth principle, the right of conscience and the use of the democratic process within our congregations and within society at large, between that and the crystallization of conscience, which is the phrase that the military itself uses for the process by which some active duty soldiers become conscientious objectors. They are said to undergo a crystallization of conscience. I should perhaps also add that the Memorial Day sermon I preached last year, that actually had the same sermon title, some of you remember, as this sermon, but I got off track talking about the many things to be said about Memorial Day and how we remember, and I realized around Saturday, too late to change the order of service, that this sermon would have to come later, and so this is the sequel for those of you who have been waiting. And when I first heard that phrase, crystallization of conscience, that military criteria for whether a conscientious objector is really legitimate or not, I was near the beginning of the 7-year period in which I served as the associate pastor and youth minister in a progressive Christian congregation in Northeast Louisiana. Still early in my transition from seminary to full-time minister, I was reflecting a lot about how myself and the congregation were called to form young people, to be progressive, open-minded followers of the way of Jesus in a world and in a region that often understood Christianity in a much more conservative, narrow-minded sense. So when I heard that phrase, crystallization of conscience, in that setting, I immediately thought, what are we doing wrong in our congregations that so many people grow up in Christian congregations around the country and leave with an uncrystallized conscience? What does it mean ethically that the armed forces are mostly recruiting young people with malleable consciences? Recall that for the global war on terror, the average age of a soldier being deployed for the first time is only 19. And what might religious communities do differently to help our congregants, our communities, and our society have consciences that are crystallized for the things that make for peace? Although I am a pragmatist and not a pacifist, part of my pragmatism is to advocate for the ways that nonviolent social change has been shown to work. Gandhi, Martin Luther King Jr., and others have shown us that large-scale, nonviolent social movements can create immense change. There's a wonderful book out there called A Force More Powerful that documents powerfully that it wasn't just King and Gandhi that used nonviolent social movements to create social change in the 20th century. Conversely, we have seen the ways that violent social change often has dire unintended consequences, sowing the seeds of future violence. We've seen that in the Middle East in tragic ways, this cycle of violence. Dr. King said it this way, "The ultimate weakness of violence is that it is a descending spiral, besetting the very thing it seeks to destroy. Through violence, you may murder the hater, but you do not murder hate. In fact, violence merely increases hate in those who are victims of it. Returning violence for violence multiplies violence, adding a deeper darkness to a night already devoid of stars. Hate cannot drive out hate. Only love can do that." The ethicist Stanley Hauerwas expresses this same sentiment differently. Hauerwas has been described as, he is a pacifist, but he's been described as the pacifist you'd want on your side in a bar fight. So Hauerwas said, similar to King, he said that killing for peace is like screwing for virginity. Except that he used a more colorful word than even I just used. He's also famous for, you get the picture. In that spirit, wanting the things that make for peace might look like splitting our current military budget in half to provide equal opportunities for our young people to be as highly trained and funded in nonviolent activism, that nonviolent activist tradition of Gandhi and King, at the same level at which we provide training and funding for the techniques of modern warfare. The current extraordinarily disproportionate funding we provide for our military has resulted in what some call the law of the instrument. That is, if the only tool you give someone is a hammer, they'll find that everything looks like it needs a pounding. We need, as a nation, to see that risking death or even dying as a nonviolent activist working for social, economic, and environmental justice is equally as courageous and in need of support and funding as the willingness to risk death in war as a soldier. Indeed, there are many times when nonviolent activism could provide an alternative to war without sowing the seeds of future conflict. I, of course, recognize just how far we are from realizing that vision. But if we fail to cast a vision for the world we dream about, then the unjust status quo has already won on all counts. And we UUs have long stood with other social progressives at the leading edge of social change, dreaming of things that people said would never be possible, but then turned out to be the case, though it took decades, even centuries of struggle in some case. Indeed, next week I look forward to sharing with you a sermon about Margaret Fuller, one of the foremothers of our faith, who rose up against the tide of misogyny in the first half of the 19th century to become Thoreau's first editor, Emerson's close friend, our first female war correspondent for a major New York daily paper, and a passionate advocate for personal liberation. The struggle against racism, sexism, classism, and others is far from over, but astounding progress has been made in recent centuries, progress that at the time seemed far from guaranteed and was far from guaranteed. Similar progress must be made in peacemaking and just war. Indeed, I'm reminded that our Unitarian forebear, Henry David Thoreau, that his famous essay, Civil Disobedience, would even go so far as to rename Holy Obedience to that which we know in our conscience to be deeply true, that essay was inspired by the experience of spending a night in jail precisely because he refused to pay taxes to support what he considered to be the unjust Mexican-American War. To again quote Dr. King, amidst all our differences and diversity, we must learn to live together as brothers and sisters, or we will perish together as fools. And regarding the intersection of Unitarian Universalism and the U.S. military, I was interested to see at UU General Assembly, that gathering of thousands of UUs each year, it will be the summer in Providence, I was interested to see that at the sermon at the Service of the Living Tradition will be given by Reverend Rebecca Montgomery, a UU who is an Army National Guard chaplain. She was deployed to Afghanistan in July of 2005 for an 18-month tour of duty, and in 2009 was named Military Chaplain of the Year. In 2011, she was promoted to Major. She and her two children live in Bethesda. In many ways, I think they're a member of River Road, Unitarian Universalist congregation. In many ways, Unitarian Universalists with our interfaith heritage are often particularly well-suited to chaplaincy in diverse settings, such as hospitals or the military. And certainly we need Unitarian Universalist voices both inside and outside the military calling and pointing out that which needs to change. So I'll be intrigued to hear what wisdom Reverend Montgomery has to share, though she may or may not have my agenda on tap for her sermon. And one interim step, though, for conscience, before we get anywhere near cutting the military budget in half, would be to advocate to change the military's requirement that conscientious objector status can only be granted to those whose conscience has crystallized in such a way that they oppose war in any form. In contrast, a growing number of people are calling for CO status to be expanded to allow for those who are conscientious objectors to a particular war, as Thoreau was to the Mexican-American War. For more information, I recommend the website, The Truth Commission on Conscience in War. The Truth Commission on Conscience in War, whose goal is to honor and protect freedom of conscience for our nation's service members and to give them a forum for telling about their experience of wrestling with conscience in the military. Our nation's military hierarchy does not currently make allowances for soldiers who are enlisting and who enlist and then come to learn new information that leads them to think that a particular war is unjust. And as UUs, we need to publicly wrestle with the tension between that policy and our first principle of the our fifth principle of the right of conscience and the use of the democratic process within our congregations and society at large. The military isn't democratic, last time I checked, and I understand the reasons why that is. But another disturbing trend is that current military training has been changed in recent years to teach soldiers to practice what is called reflexive fire, which is intentionally developed to bypass conscience or any conscience thought. What they discovered is that a very small percentage of soldiers were actually firing. That a lot of them were in the line up but weren't firing at the enemy. So reflexive fire was developed to change that. Keep in mind that conscience literally means with knowledge or awareness. So reflexive fire is meant to divert from knowledge or awareness. And Logan Mel Laturi, an Army veteran who served in the Iraq War as a forward observer and fire support specialist before applying to change his status to non-combatant conscientious objector, writes that reflexive fire is distinct from many law enforcement agencies, where trainees are taught to fire only if a target poses a credible threat. The result of operant conditioning is that repetition can callous the individual to the moral challenge of war. It effectively hardens the hearts of service members and discourages moral clarity. This should trouble us as reflective fire is closely associated with post-combat depression and suicide, as people have to come home from the war front and then wrestle with what it is they've done. In our name. When I was a youth minister, I used the related 2007 documentary, Soldiers of Conscience. Have any of you seen that documentary, Soldiers of Conscience? I recommend it to you. I used it as a tool. We watched it together and invited our young people to become more aware of their conscience, what in their conscience, that still small voice inside you that Laura named, and how it was or wasn't being crystallized. How was their conscience, that still small voice, being crystallized by society, by the congregation they were a part of, by the school, by commercials, the media? Where was their consonance and where was their dissonance? The film profiles 8 American soldiers, 4 who decide not to kill and become conscientious objectors, and 4 who believe in their duty to kill if necessary. Relatedly, I should emphasize that when Mel Laturi applied to change his status to non-combatant conscientious objector, he was not seeking discharge from the military. He was seeking that middle way I described earlier. Based on his personal experience, he was calling on the military to change their definition of CO status to include those who object to a particular war. And he wanted to continue serving in the military as a non-combatant in regard to the particular war that he had come to believe was unjust. And he continues to not believe that war in any form was objectionable. That's why he wasn't applying for full CO status. Nor was Mel Laturi seeking a coward's way out. Indeed, after leaving the army, rather than retreating to the safety of home, he went to Palestine with a team of peacemakers along the lines of that ideal that I described earlier, who were as willing to risk their lives in nonviolent activism as military professionals are willing to risk their lives in the violence of war. This particular peacemaker team organization was inspired a few decades ago by the following call, and many have served in it since. What would happen if we developed a new nonviolent peacekeeping force, even of 100,000 people, ready to move into violent conflicts and stand peacefully between warring parties in Central America, Northern Ireland, Poland, Southern Africa, the Middle East, and Afghanistan? Frequently, we would get killed by the thousands. But everyone assumes that for the sake of peace, it is moral and just for soldiers to get killed by the hundreds of thousands, even millions. Do we not have, as peacemakers, do we not have the courage and faith of soldiers? There is much more to Mel Laturi's story. If your curiosity is piqued, his book is called Reborn on the 4th of July, The Challenge of Faith, Patriotism, and Conscience. Now, Mellitori's story is told from the Christian tradition, related to his growing crystallization of conscience around his view of how the way of Jesus calls Christians to live in this time and place. So that may or may not resonate with all of you the same. So from a broader perspective, Beacon Press, the Unitarian Universalist publishing house, has released an important new book last year called Soul Repair, Recovering from Moral Injury After War. Moral injury is an important new area of research which is gaining increased recognition, including a recent article in the New York Times. A lot of important research has gone on to PTSD, post-traumatic stress disorder, from war, but PTSD is typically caused by trauma experienced in the outside world. It's something in the outside world that you experience. Moral injury is about that internal struggle from having done differently than that little voice inside you told you, or even that shouting voice inside you told you was the right thing to do. It's about that internal struggle resulting from the violation of one's conscience. And the long-term consequences of soldiers violating what they know to be right in their conscience has received far too little attention and is thankfully starting to get more attention from academics. A few months ago, when I heard Rita Nakashima Brock, one of the co-authors of Soul Repair, speak, a line from one of her interviews with veterans particularly stood out to me as a devastating example of moral injury, but a common one. The veteran confessed, "For him, feeling terrible about killing someone is a sign that I'm a moral person, and I don't want to feel better about it because that would be a sign that I'm not a good person anymore." So how do we help people walk with that tension? Treating PTSD does not sufficiently address the full experience of many veterans returning from war zones who have also experienced moral injury from the violation of their conscience. Brock and her co-author Gabriella Latini write, "There's a boot camp to intensively prepare for war and teach things like reflexive fire, but there's no boot camp to reintegrate veterans into civilian life. They were taught reflexive fire shooting, but not how to recover from a shredded moral identity." As Unitarian Universalists, we care deeply about the importance of individual conscience, and I think we must do our part to raise awareness about the need for greater individual freedom of conscience, even in the military, as well as to help veterans heal not only from PTSD, but also from the moral injury of violating one's conscience. As some of you know, this past week I was in Delaware on a UU minister's retreat about history and ritual, and one of the fascinating traditions I learned about for the first time are fast days. Do you know that our nation used to have fast days? Has anybody learned about that tradition? None of you. I'm not surprised. I hadn't either. According to Dean Grodston, a UU historian, in the 18th century, there was a regular state-sponsored fast day on a Thursday in April corresponding to the Feast of Thanksgiving on a Thursday in November. So you had feasting and fasting. Grodston writes that people generally behaved in a subdued manner on fast days and refrained from work, but their fasting was not severe. They abstained from food until evening when they would eat a simple, usually cold meal. During the day, they would attend one or more religious services. Ministers would preach special fast day sermons of admonition and of reconciliation, in contrast to the celebratory ones of gratitude preached on Thanksgiving. Fast day was the only occasion when congregations actually expected their ministers to preach on the sins of the nation. Now, I have no idea why this has fallen out of popularity. And some famous political sermons were preached on fast days. Fast day remained a legal holiday in New England, and Unitarian and Universalist churches continued to hold special fast day services through the 19th century. For a time, both fast day and Thanksgiving both looked as if they may go on the national calendar. Congress or the president would occasionally call a national day of fasting or Thanksgiving as events warranted, as opposed to after September 11th when we were called on to go shopping. Fall Thanksgiving days grew in popularity. President Abraham Lincoln established the national November holiday with two successive annual Thanksgiving proclamations in 1863 and 1864. Fast days began declining in popularity by mid-century. The last national fast day was called in response to President Lincoln's assassination in 1865. We need days of celebrating, of feasting, and of gratitude. But as we know, even the former family holiday of Thanksgiving has become increasingly crowded out by the consumerism, the go shopping of Black Friday. We also desperately need to retrieve the tradition of fast days in which we at least slow down, open our hearts, and weep for what we have done and for what has been done in our name, that we might recognize and recommit to those things that make for peace.